You're listening to New Churches Podcast, a production of Send Network on newchurches.com. We discuss all things church planting. If you're looking to take your next step toward multiplication, you're in the right place. newchurches.com provides relevant and reliable resources for church planters, church multipliers, and disciple makers. Our growing library features pastors, planters, and church leaders like Ed Stetzer, David Platt, Matt Chandler, Trillia Newbell, Christine Hoover, Dehati Lewis, Trevin Wax, and many others.
Welcome to the New Churches Podcast. I'm Ed Stetzer, and here we are helping and encouraging church planters. And one of the things we're asking today is about funding. We're trying to look at it with different angles and different approaches. So let's jump right into our conversation. I've got two guests today, Tiffany Smith. She's a regional equipper with the Send Network, doctorate in missional leadership, writes over at missionalmayhem.com. Clint Clifton, founding pastor of Pillar, family of churches and military communities worldwide, and director of resource strategy at the North American Mission Board. We're talking about funding. So if you're interested in learning more about church planter funding, check out the article posted over at newchurches.com called How Does Funding Work for Church Planting? It's an article that Clint has written that we're going to deal with some of these issues today. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to turn it over to Clint. I'm going to turn the keys of the episode over to Clint, who's going to talk us through some ways and then funding, and then bring Tiffany, who's amazing, and me, who's less amazing, into the conversation as we go. So Clint, you're up.
Well, thanks, Ed. So when I think about funding for church planting, this is one of the things that church planters that I'm interacting with are asking tons of questions on this, particularly new church planters. It seems so mystical. They don't understand how the funding piece works. Even some guys that I'm interacting with assume that it's like a business. You can go get a business loan and get started, but it's not really the way it works. So I have found these categories really helpful to sort of explain to church planters and their teams the possible approaches you could take to addressing the funding need in your new church. So we're going to talk about four of them, and I'll start with the first one. And I'm just going to basically explain the approach to you, and then interested to hear your comments on it. The first one is,
so we could just like say that's a terrible example. Yeah. Can we just like make have a gong, you know, go off or something? Okay.
That could work. All right. The first one is by far, in my experience, the most common approach, and we'll call this the Shark Tank approach. The church planter goes out on behalf of the church and he tries to raise a big sum of money from churches, networks, denominational partners. Much like the show Shark Tank, the approach depends really heavily on the quality of the church planter's pitch, how believable and viable it sounds, and it's gathering those monies together. Often those budgets in North America are somewhere between like $180,000 for a one-year annual budget up to $500,000 and $600,000, yeah, for a one-year budget. So how does that strike you guys? What advantages and disadvantages do you see to this approach?
So immediately, I think one of the advantages, obviously, is that you can get going very quickly once you get your funding together and set, and you don't have to worry about raising support over time. But a disadvantage is that the pressure is so high on that lead planter to be the star hero, to try to be the golden boy and you know, get all of this support. And I think about our ethnic planters who are speaking, you know, multiple languages, and maybe they are disadvantaged in that paradigm. You know, they wouldn't be able to communicate in the same way that maybe somebody else would about their vision and clarity as they're trying to gain support. So those are the first thoughts off the top of my head. Ed, what about you?
Yeah, definitely does benefit people who are good at kind of casting a vision, which you know, I would often say, I think I even wrote it once in a book, is that if you can't cast a vision for people to support you, you probably can't cast a vision for people to come on your team and plant with you. But I would say that, because I really benefited from this system later. So I have raised funds for a church plant, I think, four times. First time, I was 21 years of age, and I didn't benefit from that. People are like, what do you, you got a degree in biology and chemistry, and so I planted my first church co-vocationally because of that. But then subsequently, I was in a position where I knew how to cast a vision. And so I disproportionately benefited from the ability to be a smooth talker. So for good or for ill. Now, I think that's disadvantages of people of, you mentioned people of color, minority church planters and more. So what I would say is the upside of that is if you're good at telling a great story, you can build some resources that way. The downside is that that impacts other people negatively. And I think we need other ways to fund as well. But let me also say too, that this is like, if you went back 30 years ago, so my first church plant was 30 years ago. I was 21 years old, didn't know, you know, I got a lot of suspicion from people. I didn't get a lot of support because I, to be perfectly honest, 21 year old shows up at my office with a degree in biology and chemistry, wants to move to the inner city of Buffalo, New York to start a church and been married for 6 months. I don't know that I would support that church planner either, but, and this is the key thing that is now filled. So every pastor is getting these calls. So whereas a 21 year old, I might've been the only person they talked to other than somebody from, you know, from a parachurch agency. So now since church planning has become the hot big thing, you're just competing. If you're going to do a Shark Tank, you need to think about the TV show Shark Tank. There's about 15 other people behind you who are making similar pitches that have great ideas, are going to change the world too. And it's just harder, I think, to do that as well. So Shark Tank, first up, I think ultimately not without challenges, but probably still by far the more prevalent model, I would think. What's next on the list, Clint?
Yeah. Well, wait, before we move on to that, I have one other thought on the missiological kind of effects of that paradigm. So when you have a person that is the lead planter and set up in this way, it really does cultivate the imagery and the paradigm of the top-down leadership. It increases the leader-lady divide. So you automatically are going into a situation where you're going to have to kind of rethink the culture, or you're fighting against that paradigm and you're going to have to shift it. And that's hard to do. It's hard to do in any scenario, but it's hard to do when you're set up that way. It's really, you have to be very intentional about unleashing the whole of the church. Otherwise, you're going to see the lead person as the hero.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Great point. So if the Shark Tank approach is the most common approach, the least common approach, I would say, is the next one. I'm going to call this the school fundraiser approach. The church plant tries to raise money through traditional fundraising efforts like selling stuff, swag, sermons, books, you name it. They sell things in order to fund the mission. Some churches have even, you know, retail ventures like thrift shops or coffee shops, or maybe more organizational ventures like sports leagues and that sort of thing. So how's this strike you guys as advantage, disadvantage? What advantages and disadvantages do you see?
Yeah, I definitely would say it is much less common in kind of prevailing culture church plants. I've seen it in some settings and contexts. You know, a lot of it has to do with what you're selling, you know. So you could put under this category something as much as, you know, I planted a church, one church we planted, we actually sent, we called it a baby shower, have a baby shower for our new church plant. You can buy for us our nursery equipment. You can buy for us our sound equipment. That's kind of a mix of the two because you're still fundraising, but I'm kind of the view, and I'd like to get Tiffany. I'm kind of the view that man, anywhere and any way that you can ethically and appropriately develop the resources. So when I did training in, I think of two places, one in Asia and one in Africa, this would be very much more common. And it's actually, what's interesting, it's almost, I think today in most of our listeners are in North America, probably disproportionately, you know, around the world, we'd be Western culture. I think people see suspicion in a way that, and I can think of this wonderful church planter in Africa, in Ghana, that I was working with, that nobody was suspicious at all that he was selling things to help plant his church. Right. It was just like, but here people would be like, well, what's up with that? What are you selling? And what are you selling is literally a negative term in a lot of North American culture. It wasn't in Apatrapa, where this church planter was, outside of Kumasi in Ghana. So I do think that this approach could be more common in other cultures.
Yeah.
But Tiffany, what do you give us more kind? What do you think? You've seen stuff around the world.
I totally agree with you on the location. So my immediate thought was I could see this working in the right context with the right person. So I think posture of the individual would really be important. So if the community feels like it's a pushy car salesman kind of a thing, yeah, then it's going to be negative for the missional movement. But if it's a blessing to the community and they feel served and encouraged, even though they're buying some sort of commodity or product, then I think it would be super helpful. So I think the posture is important.
Yeah, I can think of one example on this. There's a church in Chantilly, Virginia called New Life Christian Church.
Yeah.
And they have an organization associated with it called the End Zone. So they basically bought an old Budweiser factory. They converted it into a sports complex, an indoor sports complex with indoor, gym and soccer fields and things like that. And they hire a management firm to come and run that for them. And it's a great indoor athletic facility. And the revenue from that funds much of the ministry. And the church is a church of about 1,000 or so.
Yeah.
And they meet sort of in a corner of this massive facility that they own, but is run as an independent sports complex.
Interesting. And I think that's some of that social entrepreneurship we talked about in, was that episode, last episode, 644, yeah, is, because I know people might hear that and say, well, that's a church of 1,000, but you could do that. I mean, and we mentioned a CrossFit gym. I mean, CrossFit gym is very openable. I don't know if that's a word.
Right.
So I do think that can be sort of a fundraiser approach.
Yeah. And my church, the church I'm involved in, we went into a partnership with a developer and we're building an apartment complex. Some of the revenue off that apartment complex will fund our ministry and mission. So yeah, there's some ways.
Okay, let's go to the next one.
The next one's the get a job approach. No fundraising needed. The planter works really hard until the church is able to offer enough support for the planter to become a staff member.
Yeah, not uncommon at all. That's a big part of what we talked about in episode 654. Two paths here, really, to diverge to. One path is to work until you are able to be full-time at the church, which is a perfectly valid, biblically, informed approach. The other is not to. In other words, to stay in that vocational ministry, gives more resources, models for people. I love, there's a church plant that grew, I wrote a book with Sergio Quiros, who's the pastor of Cidade Viva in João Pessoa, Brazil. And we wrote a book in Brazilian Portuguese together. Needless to say, I wrote it in English and he wrote his half and then translated all of it into Brazilian Portuguese. But he's a federal judge. And that then later became, I think he's currently doing this at this time. He's like works, he's a representative for the government to the United Nations. And he planted this church in this community of Brazil. And they have a rule. Well, actually, I was down there in the before time, before COVID. So I don't know what it's like now. But they had a rule then that that the people who were the primary communicators of the church all had to have a full-time job outside of the church because they wanted to model, something Tiffany's talked about, is they wanted to model people engaging in mission as just the natural outflow of their life. Mm-hmm. Now, they had vocational staff, lots of, it's grown to a large church now, started with just him, but he and Samara and their kids. But even now that they have all this large staff, the three primary communicators all have other jobs. And if you listen to them, my daughter actually lived at that campus, went to school for a semester. And so she would point out that he always is referencing his job on purpose.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of saying that this is central to what we do. So Tiffany, to you, again, this is an area you're passionate about. We say that we all got to be careful though. Mm-hmm. We're passionate about this, but none of us are doing this. Yeah. So what have you seen that we can celebrate in the get a job approach to church planning?
I love that you brought up that it models discipleship, because that to me is one of the coolest aspects of it, is that a lay leader or a member in the church is seeing before them you know, a life lived out in the marketplace, and that it's a normal practice, kind of what we talked about in the last podcast. But I've seen people who are so intertwined in the community that it gives them through their work, that it gives them an ability, not only insights into the needs and the pulse of the community and kind of what's going on, the spiritual climate and all of that, but it, it also just that relational equity that they're building up.
Well, let's move on to the next one. I'm going to call this one the campus crusade approach.
Yeah, that is such a stereotype, but so true at the same time.
Well, they've been the trendsetters in this regard.
And the larger, they're the largest mission organization in the Protestant mission organization history of the world, with tens of thousands of people doing this. But go ahead, keep going.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me how many organizations model their fundraising approach after this approach.
Yep.
But basically, this organization, largest mission agency in the world in an era of falling investment in evangelism, Bill Bright and his organization pioneered the individual missionary support model, which seeks commitments from 50 to 100 individuals to give regularly monthly amounts to support their work. So this is raising money from individuals for an individual missionary.
Yeah, and there's a Bill Dylan wrote a book on called People Raising. That sort of, so there are whole resources that people use to kind of do this well. It's one of the things I think is interesting is the immediate, and people go to peopleraising.com to see that as well. I think the immediate assumption, particularly people who maybe are in a non-denominational church that people are, you know, resourced and on staff, or maybe they're denominationally affiliated where the denomination somehow resources it. To them, it's like, how could this be? This is the most horrible thing ever. And I want to say to them, I don't remember the numbers at Crew right now, but I think there's 30,000 people. So every year, let's say Crew is 30,000 people, 30,000 Crew missionaries have, you know, 150 to 100 conversations. And, you know, of course, I've had this conversation with lots of people, and I see when they come to me as a privilege to participate. You know, I can't necessarily do that with every person in every field, but I think part of the reality is this is horrifying to a lot of people. And I think it shouldn't be, because a whole lot of people are doing it and finding it is a wonderful opportunity for people to be blessed by God to participate in the mission. And I think that's kind of the kind of thing that, that for us, we have to find this as a, not a burden. You're going to bother 100 people, but an opportunity.
Yeah, I believe that that's true as well. And I love the idea of we're a family. And so we're supporting one another. And if you are recruiting 50 to 100 individuals to support the mission, they are a part of that mission too. We're doing it together as a body of Christ. And so it, it is highly relational. It's network-based. And I can see so many benefits from that.
One of the big advantages I see here is for the serial church planter, they can take the church planting support that they're given by individuals and take along with them as they go to consecutive plants.
Yeah. Yeah. No question. I think ultimately, as we look at one of the models that we, Daniel M and I wrote about in Planting Missional Churches, was the sequential or apostolic, where I don't think there's a lot of place for people to go plant a church to plant a church to plant a church. In my denomination, we have like city missionaries. But you know, when you get a smaller denomination or other settings, you don't have that. This can be a place where, say, let's say I'm going to raise funds. I mean, these Crew people don't raise funds for a year. They, I mean, people usually commit, I think, for 3 years, but they stay on the field for sometimes decades. So if you're going to be a serial apostolic church planner, you might say, this is my ministry. I mean, evangelists have done this for a long time. I think we need to consider it for church planning as well. Okay, well, we're going a little long in this episode. So let me mention that you can learn more about funding the mission and the fundamentals of church planning by checking out the Church Planning Masterclass offered for free over at newchurches.com. And got some of the very best church planning leaders across across different the spectrum of evangelicalism. Dottie Lewis, Trillia Newbell, David Platt, Matt Chandler. The masterclass is in total 80 short video sessions providing a comprehensive overview of church planting experience from start to finish. And did I mention that because of our partnership with the Ascent Network, it's free. So everything we're doing is free. So do me a favor, like and share the podcast wherever you downloaded this. Leave a comment so people can find it as well. And check out newchurches.com. Also, thanks to Tiffany and Clint for joining us for this helpful episode.
You've been listening to the New Churches Podcast, brought to you by Send Network. If you like what you heard, take a few minutes to rate and review us or share this episode with a friend. It's the best way to show your support. To find more reliable resources to start your new church well, visit newchurches.com.